And be sure to tune in to Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. That's with me, Robert North, on 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org every Thursday night, 6 to 8 p.m. And, of course, every Sunday morning from 9:30 all the way to 1 p.m. If you're game.
The Bike Church Community Bike Shop and Tool Cooperative. It's open every Monday through Saturday, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Downtown Santa Cruz, 703 Pacific Avenue, Suite B. Call 425-BIKE. That's 425-BIKE for the Bike Church Community Bike Shop and Tool Cooperative. You do not need to be a mechanic to use the Bike Church do-it-yourself repair facility. There are folks, church ministers there, mechanics that are there to teach you how to repair your bicycle. Encourage people to learn by getting their hands dirty. Familiarize yourself with the machine and fix your bike. That's what it's all about. It's like $5 for a drop-in rate, $20 for a monthly membership. There's a website here, santacruzhub.org/bikechurch. Check it out there. Again, Bike Church Community Co-op, Tool Cooperative, Monday through Saturday, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m., 831-425-BIKE. They're located at 703 Pacific Avenue, Suite B, downtown Santa Cruz.
Where attitude changes.
The road at this point is blocked by these masked protesters.
Where progress is achieved.
Bang cricket is the game of sound.
Where the consequences are felt.
Another burial, another grave in family. Every day, people are being murdered here.
This is Al Jazeera.
Listen to Al Jazeera news reports on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org, between 7:30 and 8 a.m. weekdays. Also on the weekly World Review, Sundays at 1 p.m. Free Radio Santa Cruz, unlicensed independent radio since 1995.
Sushi bars were shuttered and the dark canteens too. I stood there in the darkness as an empty cab rolled by, when all at once I heard the sound of yuppies in the sky. The herd came down Columbus for as far as I could see. All the men were wearing polo and the women wore esprit. Each yuppie had a walkman, and as each one passed me by, I saw their sad expressions and I heard their mournful cry. Condos for sale,
condos for sale,
condos to buy,
condos for buy,
for yuppies in the sky. Each one was wearing running shoes upon the ghostly deck, and each one had a cotton sweater wrapped around the neck. They all held out their credit cards and tried in vain to buy, but all the stores were shuttered to the yuppies in the sky. Condos for sale,
condos for sale,
condos to buy,
condos to buy,
for yuppies in the sky. I'd seen them in commercial sailing boats and playing ball, pouring beer for one another, crying, why not have it all? Now I saw the ghostly progress down Columbus Avenue. I heard the cry for mercy and it chilled me through and through. Condos for sale,
condos for sale,
condos to buy, for yuppies in the sky. All the salad bars were empty, all the quiche Lorraine was gone. I heard the yuppies crying as they vanished in the dawn, calling brand names to each other as they faded from my view. They'll be networking forever down Columbus Avenue. Condos for sale,
condos for sale,
yuppies in the sky. Condos for sale,
condos for
sale, condos for buy, for yuppies,
yuppies,
yuppies in the sky.
That was Tom Paxton, I think. Yuppies in the Sky. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. If you're on the Internet, I'm Robert Norris. And coming at you a tad late, it's Bathrobe's Beers Broadsides, the June 25th, 2009 edition. Welcome. Call-in number here is 427-3772. I don't think we have a second line, but we... No second line yet. If you want to catch me off air, maybe leave me a message, you can call 423-HUFF, 423-H-U-F-F, and I will answer your call later, get back to you. But if you want to be on the air, again, the number is 427-3772. So today, we have a guest at 7 o'clock, Mike Rhodes from Fresno, talking about recent incidents over there of... possible anti-homeless activity. One of the plaintiffs in the Kincaid lawsuit, the lawsuit that won $2.3 million for homeless people and their supporters, based on the illegal actions of the police and other authorities in seizing homeless property and destroying it, a practice that's still followed here in Santa Cruz. He'll be calling in to talk about the case of Cynthia Green, I believe it is, or is it Cynthia Williams, one of the two. In any case, Cynthia, and we'll be hearing about how her tent was burned out and what's going on in Fresno around homeless civil rights. Updating in Santa Cruz, I'm going to be following a special issue which has some relevance to homeless people, the medical marijuana moratorium, as they call it, that was imposed by an emergency vote by the Santa Cruz City Council day before yesterday, Tuesday afternoon, while the rest of you were working.
Cynthia Matthews was sleeping. Mayor Matthews wasn't sleeping. She was simply allowing the staff to do what they do, which is rule city council policy. And I'm going to be playing both what happened at city council directly, which you probably will be able to review if you have television cable. You can probably get the community TV's replay of it. But I'm going to play the audio section of that particular item, which came up on the city council agenda. It's also on Indie Media, Santa Cruz Indie Media, if you want to go to there and find out some thoughts that I and others have on it. It's the lead story, prohibition on new medical marijuana dispensaries passed by Santa Cruz City Council. And the gist of my perspective is that it's a prohibitionist sort of reefer madness activity undertaken by the Santa Cruz City Council, which likes to pretend it's liberal on marijuana, but then guts commissions like the Measure K Committee, which was passed by the voters to make sure that marijuana enforcement of all kinds on in private was the lowest enforcement. And, of course, the police are not being held to that at all by any kind of independent check. We've talked about that on the air before. This was an ordinance that really came out of the blue the public heard about it on Sunday through the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the Sunday Sentinel. I brought it up on Indy Bay, I think, on Saturday because I got tipped off by Craig Canada, a medical marijuana activist who also spoke at city council on the issue. And it's essentially a complete ban on not only all new medical marijuana dispensaries, but on all new medical marijuana dispensary applications. Allegedly only for 45 days, but actually for 70 days since the Zoning Commission doesn't meet in August. And then, it's a little unclear, I actually put this question to Don Lane, Councilmember Lane, today by phone, haven't heard back from him yet. The ordinance that was passed seems to indicate that it's then up to the discretion of a staff member of the Public Works or the Planning Commission, I'm not sure which, or the Planning Department, whether that moratorium will then be continued for another 8 or 9 or 10 months. I'm not quite sure the exact span, but it's in that range. So we have a moratorium, that is say, a ban on any new openings of medical marijuana distribution centers, which means that the two existing clubs, Ken Sampson's Club and Lisa Milano's Greenway, have a monopoly in the Santa Cruz area. There have been numerous criticisms for at least Lisa Milano's Club and probably Sampson's as well, in terms of the prices, in terms of how customers are treated, in terms of how low-income people are treated, in terms of, for Milano's case, there any kind of responsiveness about she ran for city council. She was the most invisible city council candidate I've ever heard of. She didn't show up at any of the forums. Maybe she showed up at one, actually. I saw her once when the applications were being put out, but after that there was nary a whisper of where she was or who she was, and she hasn't returned a phone call in 3 years, not from me and not from others I've heard either that I've talked to, although no doubt she probably calls her friends and her banker and her marijuana supplier and so forth. I'm sure she does. Anyway, let's get to that directly, and if you have any comments, please do call in. We'll pause probably at 5 or 10 minute intervals for comments, and we may even pause if a comment comes in. 427-3772 is the call-in number. I invited one of the applicants who was essentially given the deep throat reaming, or is it the deep ass reaming by the Santa Cruz City Council, an opportunity to be on the air. He was a little reluctant to do that, although he initially agreed, but he did agree to an extensive interview. We'll be playing that interview either today or Sunday. I'm going to see how much interest this actually generates, and also I like to kind of break up the broadcast with numerous things. So let's begin. Here's Santa Cruz City Council Tuesday, and here's the introduction of the medical marijuana moratorium.
Mayor, members of the council, Alex Corey, Assistant Planning Director. For your consideration today is an interim ordinance establishing a temporary moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries and production houses. The city's medical marijuana ordinance was passed in 2000, and prior to May of this year, two applications were received and approved in 2005 and 2006. The resolution report says one of them was approved in 2004. That was my mistake. It was taken in 2004, but it was approved in 2005. Since the beginning of for the first 8 years of the ordinance, the planning department averaged a few phone calls a year regarding medical marijuana. Since the beginning of 2009, the number of calls have increased to where in the last 4 months, the planning department has received almost daily requests for medical marijuana information on dispensaries. Some of these requests are information come from local individuals, but most of them have come from all over the state, mainly from the Bay Area and Southern California, and several calls from outside the state, including Washington, Oregon, and Nevada. It appears the sharp rise in calls are a result of the U.S. Attorney General's announcement about the easing of federal enforcement on medical marijuana dispensaries in late February. Since the recent changes in the federal enforcement policy, concerns have been raised regarding the inadequacy of the current regulations to address the potential number of permit applications and the impact that such a proliferation or overconcentration of medical marijuana dispensaries and production houses within the city may have on the community as a whole. An additional concern for consideration is the fact that the City of Santa Cruz is the only jurisdiction in the county that allows medical marijuana dispensaries and production houses. We've surveyed all the local jurisdictions, and currently their ordinances do not address medical marijuana dispensaries or production houses. And in fact, looking at a map, the nearest facility that we can tell near in the area is in San Jose or Redwood City, so they're far from where we're located. This could result in, again, a concentration of dispensaries that had not been considered when the ordinance was adopted. It is recommended that the City Council adopt a moratorium and direct staff to study the current ordinance to address all the concerns above, and the standards with which the staff evaluates and conditions medical marijuana uses, and return to the council with recommendations for possible modifications to the code, if any. The reason this is being brought to the City Council as an urgency ordinance is that the Planning Department is currently processing two applications it received in May for new dispensaries, and staff is in close contact with at least two other individuals with prospective applications. Without a moratorium, staff is required to process these or any other applications in a timely manner. State law allows, with a minimum of 6 votes, the City Council to approve an urgency interim moratorium for 45 days on matters it considers to or intends to study within a reasonable time. This concludes staff's presentation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay.
Let's see here. Do we have an operational mic? I think we have an operational mic here. Here we go. This is the staff member's introduction of this urgency ordinance at the Santa Cruz City Council. And I just want to make a few initial comments. I think I and others make them later, but it's really important that people hearing this this rap that the staff report be aware of a couple things. First of all, there are no specific stats on the number of inquiries they've gotten, as though that really was terribly relevant. But there are only 2 real applications that have been filed and 2 potential applications. So you don't have any actual figures on which to go from, and you don't also have any sense of, he says that many of these came from out of the state or out of the area. How many? You know, I mean, it would be a matter of some simplicity to record this and bring it forward just for the public's information, so we know we're not getting that kind of anecdotal Zach Friend SCPD type, perhaps exaggerations or mischaracterizations, but the actual data, we don't get that. The Attorney General's new policy on supposedly legalizing marijuana use for medical purposes has not, in fact, been effectuated in terms of how courts are actually treating people who are being prosecuted in terms of prosecutions and in terms of actual raids. That's something that's really common knowledge among the medical marijuana community. So this is a misstatement of fact, or at least it's misleading, because it makes one statement of policy. I think back in February, it suggests that that is actually what's going on, when the actual behavior of the federal government is quite different. It's also misleading in a second way, in that the state itself is the main harasser of people using marijuana either medically or recreationally. You see this particularly in Santa Cruz County by Bob Lee, D.A. Bob Lee's endless pursuit of Roger Mensch, who has a medical marijuana distribution center in the county. And again, this is an example of misinformation by the staff, called the the Hemporium. And Mensch has been pursued repeatedly for giving away or selling, I should say, marijuana to people with marijuana cards, and sometimes doing so, I guess, to people out of state or something. His, in fact, so diligent has Bob Lee been in pursuing them and pursuing him, Mensch, the famous Mensch versus People versus Mensch case, resulted in a rather horrible decision by the California Supreme Court, which ruled that distribution centers, unless they are collectives or cooperatives, are all illegal, which makes Lisa Milano's club and Ken Sampson's club and probably clubs up and down the coast illegal as far as I can see, though I suppose in theory they could establish a kind of a closed membership system. I'm not aware that any of them have. I'm not aware that they have been prosecuted by state authorities on this basis, but the decision allows for that kind of prosecution in violation of the spirit and, I think, the letter of Proposition 215, which is the state initiative that actually set up, the voters set it up to say medical marijuana, leave it alone, let people grow it, let people sell it, let people buy it, and so forth. Is Santa Cruz the only jurisdiction, Santa Cruz City and the county, is Santa Cruz City the only jurisdiction in the county of Santa Cruz that allows medical marijuana? In a very limited sense, yes. It's the only jurisdiction that has specific regulations, but all the other jurisdictions have nothing banning it, and that means that state law and the state initiative rule. Hence, that the implication that these dispensaries can't be opened elsewhere and that this makes a particular crisis or panic for Santa Cruz is misleading. In another sense, it's not misleading because there is the fact that Bob Lee apparently likes to take out after medical marijuana producers in the county in spite of Proposition 215, in spite of SB 420, the state law. And so maybe some applicants are turning to Santa Cruz City because they feel that they're more likely to be protected here because there is a specific, not just because there's a specific code section in the city, but because the city apparently has political clout, and also city voters are taking a closer look at harassment of marijuana in the city based on things like Measure K, which broadly covers not only medical marijuana, but also recreational marijuana. There's Medican, which I believe, if it's not a distribution center, it's a place where you can get a card for marijuana and access to marijuana. It's in the county. The fact that there, that if it's even if it's insofar as it's true that distribution centers are further away than Santa Cruz generally, except for the two that are in the city, that makes it harder to have to go to San Jose or Redwood City or San Francisco or Oakland to get marijuana. Imposes a more significant burden on people. And the real issue, of course, is what the need is in Santa Cruz. Does the planning department suggest that, or the staff of the zoning department, planning department, suggest that there's no need for these distribution centers, and therefore this moratorium is a reasonable activity to put forward, I remind you, as an urgency measure? No such statistics appear in either the actual staff report, which you can find online. Again, go to Santa Cruz Indy Media and look up the lead story there on this medical marijuana moratorium. And there's also no such statements about that in the staff members' verbal presentation, which you just heard. Also not mentioned is how restrictive the current medical marijuana ordinance is. In 2000, this ordinance was passed and then modified. It essentially outlawed legal clubs that were then either on the ground set up or that were being made ready to set up. It was done essentially to criminalize those clubs. One of them was on Seabright, and then one was on Soquel. And I guess I know about this because attorney Kate Wells was involved in both these clubs, and she was really rueful about how the city proceeded to essentially criminalize medical marijuana clubs for 5 years. Ah, but you say, what about WAM, Women and Men's Medical Marijuana Collective? Well, WAM is not a club. WAM is a collective. that serves a much smaller number of people, and it serves them, and they, you know, they're able to get their medicine, some of them. Those who are fortunate enough to be members of that club. It's had its problems. I've been critical of it in some respects, but obviously it's good that it exists for its patients insofar as it serves them. But it doesn't serve the community in the broader sense of an open dispensary. And for 5 years, between 2000 and 2005, we had no such club because of the restrictive law, which has not been changed. In fact, the ordinance in 2005, which was the same, under which Lisa Milano's Greenway Club opened up, they had to actually grant a variance. It requires a special use permit hearing. And this is another indication. This leads us to another examination and understanding of how misleading the staff member's presentation of the case for a moratorium on medical marijuana clubs is. A ban on marijuana clubs for what initially appears to be 45 days, but then can be expanded to 9 months to so-called study the situation if the staff doesn't feel it has studied it enough. The ordinance itself is very restrictive, so you need to be 600 feet away from all kinds of things, and it was really hard for people to find a place to place their clubs. When the Pacific Coast Cooperative was closed down by the Planning Department in 2004, when it opened up right across from the Metro Transit Center on Pacific Avenue, even though there were no complaints from the community, it just was not in accord with the ordinance. It was too close to, I don't know, some children's school three blocks away or something at the Calvary Episcopal. I'm not quite sure exactly which one it was, but it's an absurdly restrictive ordinance to begin with. You might say, well, if it's absurdly restrictive, why don't we just wait until they can re-examine it and they can maybe come up with a better ordinance, and then they can reconsider applications and so forth, and so maybe a moratorium is a good idea. Well, if that were the motivation, I might be more sympathetic, but there's no indication that the staff is looking for a more liberal ordinance. In fact, everything that the staff is talking about looks like it says it's looking for a more restrictive ordinance. And restricting it means, as far as I'm concerned, because it's really hard for people to find places to open up these clubs, it's more prohibitionist. It means it's an attempt to stop marijuana from being distributed in this city area to those who want to purchase it and stop those who are selling it from selling it. So it actually increases the black market, I suppose, more opportunity for poor entrepreneurs and more opportunities for the police to arrest poor entrepreneurs. I mean, I suppose there's that aspect to it. And there have been those who have complained that the poor entrepreneurs on the street provide better marijuana at cheaper prices than the current clubs. I can't speak to that. I'm not much of an expert on it, but I have heard such claims. But obviously, having more of a supply is not a bad idea if there's more of a demand, assuming that marijuana is not something like nicotine, which is a toxic substance, or alcohol, which has a lot of toxic consequences. But there's no such restrictions on these two substances in Santa Cruz. In fact, they are well promoted and probably by some of the same people who are opposing and supporting the marijuana moratorium and opposing the opening of marijuana distribution centers. The real issue, though, well, there are a lot of them, but one of the real issues, one of the more obvious issues, is why does the Planning Department suddenly need this moratorium on medical marijuana clubs? Is it like they have to suddenly tomorrow hold a hearing and grant the applicants a decision one way or the other? And the answer is no, they don't. They actually could delay it for months. All they have to do is respond, quote, in a timely manner. And the timely manner also involves a special use permit hearing. It can involve an appeal. It can involve an appeal to city council. It involves all kinds of time-consuming things. I think it took Milano's club months and months and months to open. So this is bullshit that they need extra time to, because they're going to be forced, snowed with a rash of applications. They had two applications, and then they had papers taken out for two more. That's what they had. And they used that as the pretext to buffalo, well, I don't even know if the city council was buffaloed or just believe everything the staff tells them. blindly indifferent to the realities. It really strikes me as something outrageous. And you can find a lot of discussion of this online if you go to the Santa Cruz Sentinel story on the issue from yesterday. There's a lot of comments on the item, and I've actually found it a rather intelligent discussion. There's a lot of criticism of existing clubs and the idea that, well, they're profiteering and there should be restrictions on profiteering and people who are low income should have access to clubs and they don't. And I agree with these things. But that's not really the issue here. The issue here is any kind of access to increased marijuana distribution at all is being cut short by this reefer madness type ban, and it's being done with this sublime hypocrisy that the Santa Cruz City Council is so good at, which is, we're so progressive, and we're only doing this, for your own good, and it has nothing to do with adopting a kind of drug war police mentality, when in fact it tends to have, seems to me, everything to do with that, plus the NIMBY attitude of some neighbors who are afraid of a medical marijuana dispensary in the neighborhood, and that obviously should be discussed. Marijuana is a very costly and valuable resource these days because of the black market and the absurd criminalization that we have. And, it may provoke some kinds of crime, it may require extra security measures, but they admitted in their report there were no problems with the two existing clubs in terms of that kind of situation. So they haven't had those problems, and they're suddenly claiming they're going to be such problems, and they're kind of weaving that out of thin air. And it seems like the whole report that we heard reflects, if you read the written report, it reflects the verbal report you just heard. It's very vague and just makes a number of allegations that are thin, and some of them irrelevant, some of them not supported by the facts. But essentially ignoring other things like the need for people to have medical marijuana, the costs to the people who've actually found a way to open up these dispensaries, found a landlord who will allow them to do it, and now they have no access, no opportunity, and in fact they'll just lose thousands and thousands of dollars is what they expect is likely to happen because they can't afford to keep their leases. So it essentially kills the medical marijuana clubs that were about to open without a real hearing, and that's the other issue. If NIMBYs, or people who have genuine concerns, NIMBY is not in my backyard, for those who don't know what the acronym means, those who have real concerns about medical marijuana in their neighborhood, for all kinds of reasons, traffic, I don't know, I don't like the children excuse because I think it's a bunch of horse shit, if you've got a drugstore open, you don't worry about children being impacted, whereas drugstores are much more dangerous, as are alcohol and tobacco outlets. And there's not a big thing about children in that situation. The children are always hauled out when people want to essentially engage in some kind of prohibitionist mentality. They start waving the red flag of the children. But if you do have those concerns, and some do, whatever concerns you have, you take it through the process that's already been established. Endless and restrictive, though that process may be, it already is, so you have an opportunity to raise all these issues and discuss them in an adequate amount of time. But Cynthia Matthews, our mayor, at the city council meeting, allowed the applicants 2 minutes to make their case, whereas they would normally be allowed 5, 10, 15 minutes at a permit hearing. They don't get a chance to make their case. The whole thing gets frozen and buried and stopped dead in its tracks. Anyway, let's hear some more of the public comment, and then I welcome your calls at 427-3772. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM Freak Radio. We're talking about a medical marijuana moratorium ordinance passed by the Santa Cruz City Council 2 days ago. You can read about it in the paper if you go to Medical Marijuana Moratorium Santa Cruz, Google for that, and you'll find articles both on Santa Cruz Indie Media and in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Sentinel article, of course, is also pretty shallow, doesn't cover these issues, just sort of quotes the applicants as saying we're screwed, and quotes the city as saying, well, we want more time to study the issue, as though there's something to study and some reason to stop the normal process that might actually have a justification without giving what that justification really is.
Start to see if there are any questions of that. Nope. Okay.
And this also pissed me off. I sent a letter to Don Lane, council member, who in the Sunday paper gave out a long statement of support for this medical marijuana moratorium, and I asked him if he would ask some questions of the staff about the issue. And some of the questions that I suggested were what I've already mentioned before. And what I'd like to do is just, I'll read briefly a few of the questions I asked, but none of which he was willing to ask or any other council member was willing to ask. In fact, the council members didn't ask any questions at all. It was amazingly quiet from the city council. I mean, normally they will say something. I think Rotkin made a statement. He was the only person that, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe there was somebody else who made a statement, but there were very, very few questions asked about this. And promises were made. Lane promised he would be asking a number of questions. And in the past, he began, you know, months ago when I and others asked him to ask questions about anti-homeless laws in the first council session that involved those laws. He did. He asked some questions, and we all thanked him for it. And, you know, we had some respect and some communication with the Santa Cruz City Council, even though his vote did not follow, I think, the impact and the import of the questions. He voted in favor of all the anti-homeless laws that came up. But specifically, I'm trying to find this email that I sent. Here is. It's let's see. He did, however, in a subsequent show, I'm going to talk about other aspects of the city council meeting, which I guess have some interest. But let me first find this email, which I'm having a little trouble locating. And I apologize for the delay here. I thought it would be immediately. And it's not. So I'm going to play some more of this while I'm looking for the questions. If you have your own questions or comments, you can call in 427-3772.
Just one. So in San Jose, there is a dispensary, but we don't know if the city or the county, what their regulation is for.
In San Jose?
Yeah, you mentioned there was some of the closest ones.
Well, we looked on the website to see what the nearest locations of nearby medical marijuana dispensaries are. There was one shown in Felton, but the county doesn't seem to recognize it. And the nearest one after that was in San Jose. We're not sure if that's really a recognized location. And then the next one after that was Redwood City, which we're not sure is a legal one either. So the nearest after that is the Bay Area.
Okay, so those are ones that you've discovered exist, but in terms of policy out of those counties?
We're not sure.
Okay.
So the original claim that there are no account that dispensaries are banned or not allowed elsewhere in the county is kind of suddenly just sort of crumbles, and we're not sure. They have no regulations or rules. The one he's talking about in Felton is the Hemporium. That was the one that Bob Lee went after ruthlessly on two different occasions. That's Roger Mensch's medical marijuana distribution center. So Santa Cruz isn't the only jurisdiction that allows it. The entire state allows this, unless there are regulations banning it. And that is nowhere mentioned here, of course. And it isn't brought up by the city council members. It's hard to believe some of them don't know this. Maybe they don't. It's certainly harder to believe that the staff doesn't know this. So it's essentially a fraud is being perpetrated on the community around this issue. The idea that there's a sudden need to do something immediate, a real emergency, because two applications have come in and two more are being considered for under the very restrictive ordinance that the Santa Cruz currently has for medical marijuana in the city of Santa Cruz, not because other nearby jurisdictions don't allow it, but actually because Bob Lee, the friendly prosecutor, takes out after them with a hatchet, or at least takes after the one high-profile guy, Roger Mensch.
Yeah, we're going to get public testimony on this, which I welcome.
This is Mike Rotkin.
I want to say that
logic of doing having a moratorium where we can figure out how to rationally respond to the situation makes an awful lot of sense to me. It'd be different if we're saying we're putting this off for 6 years and we think about it later. A reasonably short period that's been suggested by our staff seems to be a completely reasonable level to respond to this. But I want to make clear that I'll wait for the public testimony, but if I end up supporting this, which I suspect I will, it has no indication about what I think, whether we need more or don't need more or anything else. I think it does make sense for us to look at this rationally and understand what the nature of the situation is. Earlier, people were basically taking a huge risk to open these places up. They were legal by state law, but facing federal prosecution if they opened them. That's gone away, and now all of a sudden, people apparently from all over the West Coast seem to think Santa Cruz would be a great place to open up this business. We're already being barraged.
And what you have here are a series of either ignorance statements or lies by Rotkin, which I've already gone through. There's no stats indicating a huge number of applications. There are two applications that have been filed and two more for which papers have been taken out. And then the number of inquiries of an undetermined number. There's this claim about this federal case, which a federal policy of not prosecuting, which isn't true. They are prosecuting. So that hasn't changed. Although, you know, it's reasonable to say probably there are more applications now than there were a year ago, for sure. But the real issues are not being addressed by Rotkin at all, and his claim that he's going to rationally consider this is interesting because he has absolutely nothing to say after half an hour of public commentary, which you're about to hear, and he simply just goes ahead to rubber stamp, as do all the other council members, the staff report with zero discussion. And his discussion that you've just heard, again, similar to the staff report, is pretty thin. It also shows either this incredulous approach, this credulity, this I believe anything the staff says attitude that Rotkin is taking, or it shows that he knows this is a bunch of bullshit, but he doesn't care. And he has some other reason for passing this medical marijuana moratorium. Maybe his friends on the West Side are pressing him to do it. Although this, I guess, is pretty far out on the West Side. You know, you can't really do medical marijuana except in the industrial zones. They've made it very difficult to open up these clubs. And if you want to read the actual law, go to the Santa Cruz Indy Media, and it's there on the Santa Cruz Indy Media story, medical marijuana moratorium, again, Santa Cruz, and you'll find those two stories. I did find a letter that I wrote to Don Lane where he wrote back to me that he would couldn't give me a response, and he tends to ask some of the questions. He didn't ask a single one. Or if he did, he didn't ask them publicly, and he didn't give us any of the answers. The indication of why there's an emergency at the moment, which I asked, it's an interesting thing. The emergency requires 6 votes. Usually an emergency requires 5 votes. Normally passing a piece of legislation to the Santa Cruz City Council takes 4 votes, or a majority of those who are in the city council. So it could be 3 if there's 5 people there on out of the 7 sitting that normally would come into the city council meeting. But if it's an emergency legislation, it normally requires 5. This requires 6. So it would seem to be a much higher level of require much more proof that there is an emergency. And there's no such evidence of any kind. It's not presented. Not one council member says, well, what's really the emergency? Well, the fact that you're getting more applications. Isn't the law as restrictive and cautious and slow as ever? Don't you, in fact, have 4 or 5 months if you want to delay this yourself? Why do you need a specific moratorium? And none of these questions get asked. And then, you know, I asked, what are the specific health and safety problems that require this rush job? And no such answers come out. How many application forms have been taken out? Well, we learned that 2 forms were taken out and 2 were returned. So you had a total of 4, I believe. Although this, I'm not sure where I got this information because I don't think it came directly from the, may have come from the hearing later on, but it didn't seem to be a part of the initial presentation as I remember it. The federal policy came out in February, and we suddenly get an emergency item in June, just about the time after the applicants have put in their funding request, and that's to say have paid their money for their application, thousands of dollars, and have paid for their lease, thousands of dollars, and then suddenly they're going to stop it dead in its tracks with no caring about these two particular clubs, and also no caring about, more important, you know, who cares about the profiteers, some would say, we're making money off of this, but no caring about the needs of people in the area. no interest in that whatsoever. There's no claim that the needs of the people in the area are being met adequately. There's, you know, no staff member says that. No council member says that. They just say, let's put down a moratorium for 45 days, which again can become pretty quickly 9 months. And I will get to that too and read you the specific ordinance wording that shows you my concern about that. Here's some more of the hearing, Santa Cruz at the Santa Cruz City Council. The rush job rubber stamp of the medical marijuana moratorium.
I get emails and letters from our citizens expressing huge concern about not one of these things next door to their house. At this point, they would be allowed by residents anyway, but they are allowed currently in commercial zones with some restrictions and so forth. So we'll hear from the public. And
again, Rodkin has there's no indication or information to the public that there will be a whole special use permit hearing on these issues, that you need to really show all kinds of problems and conditions are dealt with if residents raise issues. And that hearing is now being postponed and essentially made moot because, as I understand it from the applicants, they can't afford to wait months and months and months on this issue. They can't afford to pay for a lease over a long period of time when they have no business open.
I want to say that the logic of this moratorium does not speak to the question of whether it's good or bad to have more of these. It says we should think about rationally how we should approve them and what should the criteria be.
So I am going to ask that those who want to speak address their comments to the moratorium concept specifically.
And though Matthews, that's the mayor's voice, Mayor Matthews said that, address your comments to the moratorium, she did not in any way enforce that with respect to residents. In fact, she didn't enforce it at all. They kind of let people wander around, probably because the council members didn't seem to respond in any way to the comments that were made. They simply seemed to have made their minds up before they entered the room, and they passed on their judgment. 7-0, shut down all applications for marijuana clubs, first for 45, actually 70 days, and then for a longer period of time at the discretion of the ever-wise Santa Cruz staff. Planning department people can make that decision independently of the community, of the applicants, of the people who need marijuana, of the public generally.
I don't want to speak on this. Let me get a show of hands. One, two, three. Okay, a couple minutes each. That'll take us to a little past 5. Yeah. If you can do it in less than 2 minutes, we can.
Probably not. I have a lot to say about this. My name is Craig Canada, and I'm not particularly happy with the dispensaries, a lot of them today, and how they're managed and what they're doing. And I do believe that organized crime, there's too much of that in the movement. But I oppose the moratorium. As a matter of fact, I haven't been to dispensaries here since November after City Coast Co-op was raided. Mike Clifford seemed to me to be the only big person locally that cared about patients. I go to San Francisco about once a month because I can save $150 over what it costs here. I can't afford the price of compassion in San Francisco, in Santa Cruz. And it's much better quality. It hasn't been keefed. I have a lot I'd like to say about what I think is wrong with your current ordinance, 1300, I think. I was a member of the club in San Francisco in 1995. I'm a victim of SSRIs. And so I particularly want to address the use for psychiatric conditions. But I was a member of the club in 1995, and that was in San Francisco, the San Francisco Cannabis Cultivators Club. This was a year before the passage of the Compassionate Use Act of 1996. It was on Venice. It was downtown, 1444 Market, right here at Venice Market. It was a five-story building. The ground floor was the offices of Prop 215. The next floor was the club offices and their weighing room and their back room, and then there was a indica floor and a sativa floor. You had smoking, there was cafe seating. A lot of healing took place, and I haven't seen anything like that here, and I think it's a betrayal of the movement.
Yes.
So
a lot of people that want to comment, so I would ask you to line up, be ready to speak. That way we'll move through the comments as quickly as possible.
Hey, good afternoon. My name's Edmund Doyle, and I support the moratorium for the fact being that I feel personally that medical marijuana is designed, was voted on by the people to benefit individuals in need, and what's happened is that it's become a opportunity for individuals to make vast sums of money and with no transparency. What I would like to have considered during the moratorium is to make only a non-profit status purely that goes, the profits are all gone back into feeding homeless, shelters, needs of the society rather than enriching those few who managed to get a permit to open up a dispensary. So my suggestion in closing is that it should be a not total non-profit, transparent organizations that are allowed. I think you'll see that the requests for opening a club in Santa Cruz from the hundreds that you're talking about will diminish rapidly down to the few who earnestly want to help the community in its time of needs. That's my statement. Thank you.
And again, the problem with this argument, and it would be nice if it were true anywhere in California that anybody actually did this, he wants to ban all marijuana sales for profit. And there are those who favor a cooperative economy generally. I'm actually sort of sympathetic to this view. But I don't think he would ban other things for profit. Just apparently now it's just medical marijuana. And that makes it sound like a special interest argument. That is to say, he's not really believer in this philosophy generally, but because it would cut back marijuana clubs, which is the real objective, it's not, you know, it's something that he would support, and he calls for that. I mean, the city under an Erotkin resolution passed, I believe, in 2005 or 2006, as established an Office of Compassionate Use. And in theory, the city could be selling marijuana if Rotkin and the city council had any balls on this issue and were willing to do it. But they're afraid to do it because they're afraid they'll be prosecuted by the feds. If they weren't afraid, you would think they would have done so after this supposed great floodgate was opened in February by the federal pronouncement. I'm not sure who made the pronouncement. I think it was an official in the Obama administration that they weren't going to be prosecuting medical marijuana distributors when, in fact, they continue to do so anyway, just like Obama is going to take us out of Iraq, but he's increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan and not significantly reducing the number of troops in Iraq either, where, you know, we're getting an increased war and we're getting special appropriations for war. Now, we're getting lies from the federal government. Nothing new about that, but the idea that we should base our city policies on such lies is ridiculous, and I don't believe for a minute that the city council necessarily believes these things. They know better. They are simply, however, succumbing to those who prefer not to have medical marijuana clubs opened up in their neighborhood or even discussed being opened up in their neighborhood. So it's a sabotage measure, a special interest measure for those people, some of whom apparently have liquor interests, by the way, according to the applicant, who are interested in banning marijuana clubs in Santa Cruz except for the two that currently exist. They claim they're going to study it, but that's really a ban. Now, I want to correct something I said a moment ago, or a few minutes ago, which has to do with the actual government code section that is involved. And I'm kicking this from the staff report, so I got to watch out. The staff report is not always the most accurate. As I said before, it's got some problems, no question about it. But the staff report does cite the actual law involved in terms of this medical marijuana moratorium. It says, this urgency interim ordinance would place a 45-day moratorium on the issuance of use permits, building permits, business licenses, or any other entitlement for the establishment or operation of medical marijuana dispensaries and production houses. And pursuant to a government code 65858, city council with a minimum of 6 votes may to protect the public safety, health, and welfare of the community. It's hard to keep a straight face as I read this. Adopt as an urgency measure an interim ordinance prohibiting any uses that may be in conflict with the contemplated general plan. In other words, they really cooked up. They looked for an ordinance they could use to stop the marijuana clubs, and they found this. It's considered that it may be in conflict with the contemplated general plan, specific plan, or zoning proposal that the legislative body is considering or studying or intends to study within a reasonable time. So in other words, this 45-day moratorium is to give the city council a chance to study and consider that uses may be in conflict with a contemplated general plan, specific plan, or zoning proposal that the legislative body, the city council, is considering or studying or intends to study. There's no indication they intend to study anything. There was no indication of a specific set of rules, whether that's for non-cooperative clubs or, I'm sorry, for cooperatives rather than for-profit clubs, which might be a great idea, you know, or for more low-income access, which also might be a great idea, or for the city itself to take over marijuana sales, which is another good idea. No, none of this stuff is really going to be considered, or at least we have no indication through any of the discussion or staff report that there's anything specific that's being considered. Instead, you have this vague concern that there are two applications that have been filed and two applications that have been that have been asked for. And a number of other people have requested information. This is a form of hysteria and panic, or it's simply a form of using this kind of fear tactic to essentially short-circuit the usual process. And I guess I keep repeating it because it seems so, it pisses me off so much. But I do want to correct one thing. It's, according to the staff report, and again, I am not looking at the law, the staff report says if the 45-day moratorium is inadequate to complete the above-mentioned study, and there's no study here, but let's assume there is for the purposes of argument, staff would need to return to the City Council to extend the moratorium as required under Government City Code 6585 for an additional 10 months and 15 days. It should be noted that moratorium would delay the processing of the two current applications. Actually, it'll kill the processing of the two current applications, according to at least one of them, according to the applicant. So I was wrong in saying that there is an automatic 10-month extension at the discretion of a staff member. It looks like, again, if you trust the staff report, and I got to go back to the actual law, which I haven't done, but I find it hard to believe they're going to lie this openly about the process. But who knows? You know, I'm there. They're not the most accurate people in the world when they're arguing before a city council that is prone to rubber stamp them. They don't have to be. It seems that they actually are going to have to go back to city council in September and say, gee, we haven't come up with enough information in our study. Give us 10 months and 15 days. By that time, it may be a moot point because the people that are applying will have run out of money, can't afford to keep the lease you know, that they've secured on these places and are moving along. Now, you might say, well, if that's the case, then maybe this was a rush job, because if they can't afford to wait until September, this would have rushed the application through. I don't think that, maybe so. You know, maybe it would have, maybe the applicants considered that it was likely that they would have their application granted because they had dotted all their I's, crossed all their T's, learned from any problems with the previous two clubs, which apparently there weren't very many problems, at least in the eyes of the city, the two clubs that are currently open, and they were prepared to go ahead fairly quickly. This frightened the staff for fear that, or it frightened the neighbors, or frightened both, maybe the police department, it's hard to tell who's actually, you know, putting the pressure on here. And so they pulled out this moratorium. Don't know what's going on for sure. Anyway, here's a little more public comment. Then I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn to another subject, like I know I am, because I'm going to be getting a call shortly from Mike Rhodes of Fresno. In fact, I think I will actually tell those who are listening to come on back on Sunday. I don't hear a flood of calls, so I don't know if there is a lot of of interest in talking about the subject. If there is, you know, call in. We can talk about it briefly. But I'm going to be, again, playing, I think, some of the more interesting aspects of the interviews from the applicants themselves, or one of the applicants and his associates, about what this really means in terms of the ability to actually open up a club and how it's going to essentially hobble it and cripple it. And I'll be back talking about this probably 9:30, 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, 2 or 3 days down the road, I guess, 3 days down the road. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And we do have a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rose in Fresno.
Have you been smoking dope lately there, Mike?
I was listening to your show. That was kind of interesting. I'm surprised that Santa Cruz doesn't have a more liberal or progressive take on medical marijuana.
Yeah, they have a nice, there's the illusion of that. I mean, back in 2002, city council members distributed marijuana for WAM or to WAM members, but that was at the same time that during that period of time, they refused to allow clubs to open up for 5 years during that period of time by adopting this the very restrictive ordinances that are currently in place, and it's kind of bizarre. What's the situation in Fresno with medical marijuana?
We don't have any medical marijuana dispensaries in Fresno at all. People I know go to Visalia, which has two. They're just maybe 30 miles south of us. Or they go up to San Francisco. A friend of mine who just went down to Visalia said that it is extremely expensive and much lower quality than what is available in San Francisco. So people, I think, tend to take trips up to the Bay Area and visit the dispensaries there, but hey, we don't have anything here.
So, do you have any information about in the homeless community? How many homeless people are users of medical marijuana or are affected by how Fresno the lack of dispensaries in Fresno?
Well, I mean, I'm sure it's an issue, but it's certainly not the top issue on people's minds, unless they've been arrested or, cited for using marijuana. Then it probably is a bigger issue for them. It's very, very backward here with those kinds of laws. There was somebody that opened a dispensary here about 6 months ago, and it was like shut down within a day or two. The police are just like, you know, on that stuff like white on rice.
What basis do they shut it down? What do they claim was the reason?
I think that there was an I that wasn't dotted or a T that wasn't crossed in some application. And, you know, when they're looking for that kind of stuff, they'll always find something. So the word that I heard was that there was just some irregularity in the application, and that the police came by and shut it down. They parked out in front of it at first and sort of like scoped it out and watched who was going in. And within a day, they had shut it down. So actually, some friends of mine are talking about opening one here because of the apparent change of the stated laws of the Obama administration. And the thinking was that because the federal government wasn't going to cite people if it wasn't against state law.
But it's not the feds that you're concerned about in Fresno. As here, it seems to be the local state authorities, right, and local police.
Yeah, you're right. But you know, the police that I've talked to or that I've heard about, you know, they seem to take the position that, you know, it's the federal law, it's against federal law, therefore they're going to enforce it. So if the Obama administration is saying that they're taking a new take on it and they're not going to enforce federal law when it is in conflict with state law, then it would seem that it would be legal to have a dispensary here.
So, I expect you to invite me over for a medicinal session once. I have my medical marijuana card, you realize, so. I'm ready to puff if necessary. So
doesn't surprise me at all, Robert.
Well, you know, you have to stay.
But yeah, there was a case here not long ago at the federal courthouse that I was talking to the people outside the courtroom, and this is a guy from Modesto that was running a dispensary in Modesto. He had all of his permits. He was paying taxes. The feds came in and busted him, and they convicted him. And he's like gonna, you know, I mean, he could spend like 10 years in jail for this. It's absolutely insane. At least I think so.
Insanity is their middle name on drug war stuff. And homeless people are often at the forefront of this because, you know, they have no homes to hide in. Is there much prosecution of poor people for marijuana use?
You know, I haven't heard that so much. I did talk to a friend of mine who lives in the H Street encampment in downtown Fresno today. He said that the police were raiding them every day and arresting people, mostly on other drug charges. He didn't mention marijuana. He was talking about either meth or crack. That was the big offending drug at the encampment on H Street. And that it was just like a daily thing, that the police were just coming in every day and arresting people for either drug sales or drug use. I think it's mostly drug sales. Now, one of the things he was saying, too, is that the people who are selling the drugs at the encampment are not the people that live there. They're sort of, you know, different groups of people that come in and sell the drugs, and they're not actually living at the encampment themselves, but they sort of use it as a
base
sort of operation. Yeah.
Now, why don't you give folks, regulars who listen to the show, may have some sense of the three different encampments, large encampments, homeless encampments that exist in Fresno. The fact that Fresno beat back the Fresno advocates like yourself beat back an anti-camping law, an anti-homeless anti-camping law last year. And that there has been, of course, the famous Kincaid decision that has gotten a chunk of change to homeless people, allowed for some housing accommodations, and to some extent restrained the police in some respects, and that other lawsuits are currently being filed as well. But give us a little of the what are the three encampments? Where are they? How many people are in them? What percentage of the homeless population is covered by them? Well, I'll stop there, and you can catch up.
Sure. Okay. Well, you know, most of the large encampments, well, I would say all of the large encampments in Fresno are in the downtown area, and they're sort of south in the old industrial section of downtown Fresno. The Fresno Police Department and City Sanitation has sort of taken a hands-off approach to the encampments and allowed them to develop and grow, and people have built large structures there, structures that are built out of wood, that have foundations, little homes, if you would, multiple rooms, doors on, you know, in the front, and, you know, they lock them. And so it's a regular little community.
How many people are involved in this? How many people live there?
It ebbs and flows. The largest one really has been the H Street encampment, which is sort of consists of two different separate groups, but they're all basically in the same area. There's a group of people that live under the overpass there, and there's probably 50 to 75 people living there, mostly African Americans. And then on the open lot, people who've been building these homes out of wood, mostly Mexicans, there's probably somewhere between 100, 150 people living in that section. There may be at times as few as 150 people total there. It may swell up sometimes to 300.
A lot of ICE raids on any of these places?
Haven't noticed that, to tell you the truth. I probably would have heard if there is, but ICE has not been a significant factor in any of this.
That's the immigration and naturalization people, for those who don't know.
Yeah. You know, mostly just the local police, the Fresno Police Department. They're usually there, and largely it's the bicycle team that comes through because they're sort of like, you know, just like there. You know, they don't come in usually with their cars or squad cars or motorcycles or anything. They ride up on, they pedal up on their bicycles. And
Do social service agencies pay much attention to these encampments and try to serve them? I know that you were able to get a couple of porta-potties, expensive, well-guarded porta-potties in some cases, to set up there. I mean, is there clean water? Is there a medical facility for people? Is there any outreach to people in these areas from Fresno Social Services, or are there any Fresno Social Services?
Oh yeah, there's social services, but largely no. But there's been some attempt, I think, lately by Greg Barfield, who's the homelessness czar in Fresno. He's been hired. He's been working about 6 months or so now. You know, he gets like a very good salary to do this.
I was going to ask how much a year.
I think it's like $80,000 a year or something. Mm-hmm. $89,000, something like that. So he gets paid pretty well, and he has been bringing some social service workers into the encampment on H Street. He said all along that he wants to give homeless people vouchers to put them into apartments and get them off of out of the encampment. Talked to somebody today that said it actually is starting to happen, that Greg has handed out a few of these vouchers. But what seems to be happening is that people are being put in motels along Motel Row. These are very, very cheap housing units. One of them was just recently shut down because the facility was so poorly managed, and there was like open sewers and holes in the walls, and they didn't replace windows. So they shut them completely down, and people had to move to another one of these motels.
It's a step up from the H Street encampment or not?
Arguably. It's pretty similar, but, you could...
What's the status of abandoned housing or available housing in Fresno? If somebody really wanted to house homeless people, even without building any new housing, what is there a lot of abandoned or available housing or not?
Thousands and thousands of foreclosed homes that are boarded up and just sitting there. And, you know, I'm absolutely certain that a lot of homeless people live in those houses, and they leave, you know, if the police come. And it's just, like, not talked about very much, but it does happen.
And what about the money, the several million dollars that the mayor was given in the 10-year plan to end homelessness? Is any of that being spent on housing or services that you know? You told me that last year very little of it or none of it was spent, right?
Well, they had $3 million in their budget to buy property and to rehabilitate buildings for the homeless, and they didn't spend any of it. Greg was talking about rolling some of that over into the next budget this year. The budget hasn't been finalized yet, and even if it is, it's like, well, they would have probably done that anyway, and there's no guarantee that they're going to spend it anyway. So homeless issues is just way down on the list of the city of Fresno. They would rather do just about anything than to help the homeless.
What about go ahead.
You mentioned the portable toilets that they have out there and asked me about that. Those are costing the city $13,000 a month for three portable toilets and a trash bin. It's just that's how they spend their money. They're also spending, I'm not sure I have the number, but I think it's about $150,000 a year they give to the Poverello House to run and maintain about 75 tool sheds that they put homeless people in. And so even the money that they do use, it's not used for particularly good things.
The percentage of people that's covered by the Poverello House, the H Street encampment, the vouchers, the other encampments, what percentage of homeless people are not involved? I mean, does this actually serve? 5%, 50%, 90%?
A lot of homeless people live in the downtown area. A lot of them go to the Poverello House for meals. So people will go, several hundred of them every day for lunch and dinner, and maybe 100 or so go to the rescue mission.
I'm talking about shelter, though. How many
shelter?
What percentage of the homeless population is sheltered at night, either through, the Poverello House's tool sheds, or through these encampments?
Okay, so you might have 150 people in the tool shed, 100 people at the rescue mission, and 20 at a place called Naomi's House. It's for women only. The rescue mission is for men only. The tool sheds can be either men or women. So a couple of hundred people. There's shelter space for a couple hundred people in Fresno. And 250 maybe.
Which is about what percentage of the homeless population in your estimation?
I would guess that there's at least 10,000, maybe as many as 20,000 homeless people in Fresno on any given night. So it's just I can't do the numbers in my head, but it's just a minuscule portion of the number of people that are out there. Other people who are homeless, live in their cars, they live, on the street, they live, if they're lucky, maybe they move in with a family member for a couple of days or so. You'll see homeless people all over Fresno, just about every street corner. People are pushing their carts. People are standing on the street corners asking for money.
Now
there's just more and more people all the time.
Now in Santa Cruz, we've been trying for years to, bring a legal challenge to the sleeping ban ordinance here, the municipal code that makes it illegal to sleep or cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night. We have 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people in the city and space tonight for about 40 or 45 of them. And, you get more in the winter, 170 spaces or space for 170 people, but very small percentage. And I guess the question I have is, it's also illegal to sleep in your vehicle in Santa Cruz generally, on all public property without exception, and much private property, even if you have the permission of the owner, though there are some exceptions. Now, what's our response to that has been, we've begun a boycott, an educational campaign that encourages people to patronize stores in downtown Santa Cruz that display a little plaque that says, we don't discriminate against the homeless, and we favor the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. It's a sort of a gentle response to encourage merchants to sort of start addressing this issue, and also to encourage shoppers to patronize stores that have this up in their windows or in their stores, and to ask questions of the stores that don't, and maybe even boycott them, particularly the one store that we are focusing on right now, which is Bunny's Shoes. Along Pacific Avenue, we have a protest there every Saturday at 1 o'clock. We'll be having that protest for those listeners who are listening in. 1 o'clock Saturday, 1350 Pacific. Come on down. It's near the Palomar Hotel. So I'm wondering, our legal resources are very limited. And, in fact, it seems like many of the legal resources of the city are arrayed against us. But what's the situation in Fresno? You had some out-of-town legal folks coming in to really help out, three different groups, and they won the Kincaid case. But what about the ongoing cases of people who are, and now we can get into what I guess I originally called you about, because I read your emails and I saw your stories on Indie Bay Central Valley, Santa Cruz Indie Media of the Central Valley, which people can go to. By the way, we're talking with Mike Rhodes, an activist from Fresno, which what you were talking about on that particular story has to do with violence against homeless people, either in the form of, fires that get started, or in the form of direct police violence against homeless people. And what kind of legal resources are available in the activist community for the homeless? I mean, do you have a cop watch that is in any way focused on or organized around monitoring, at least chronicling and kind of documenting and recording instances of police misconduct toward homeless people? Is that anywhere near? We're trying to kind of encourage that to get together here in Santa Cruz, where it's slowly maybe happening. What's happening in Fresno around that?
Well, there's a lot to bite off there. I kept thinking of new things as you were talking. One is I wanted to mention to you that there was another legal victory here, which has not been talked about yet. In fact, your audience has probably been here before people in Fresno know about it.
All right.
And that is that...
Breaking news.
Well, pretty much. We just heard that the case against the rescue mission has been settled. And to go back and explain a little bit what that was about, the rescue mission, which is one of the service centers in the downtown area that services homeless people, have been sending their crews out, which they call disciples, out into the homeless encampments and destroying homeless people's property. They would go and collect it, throw it in a dumpster, and then haul it away. And, you know, we felt that that was wrong even before, you know, we had the suit against the city of Fresno. And then when we were in court, the director of the rescue mission got up speaking on the city's behalf and said exactly that, that that's what they do. They go out and they throw away homeless people's property. And we were kind of appalled by that, although we knew it, but it was like, you know, to say that in open court was seemed sort of like awfully bold. And so we got the people together that this had happened to. We went out and we found a number of homeless people who had their property taken and thrown away by the rescue mission. And there was just amazing stories there about what had happened. For example, this one person got back to their home, and all their stuff was gone. So they went to talk to the director at the rescue mission and asked for their property back, because their neighbors told them, well, it was the disciples came and took your stuff. And so they go and they talk to this guy, Larry Arce, the Reverend Larry Arce, who's the director there, and asked for their stuff back, and he said go fuck themselves. And they went out into the dumpster at the rescue mission and rooted around in there, and they found a blanket and some clothes and some other things. They didn't find everything, but they found some stuff.
And so, were you there with your trusty video camera recording this?
I was not, but there were people that were, and I have some photos of this incident. Lisa Apper and her husband Brian, they're with the Catholic Workers. They went with this person to reclaim the property, and so they took pictures of it when they got it out, and then they started walking down the street back to her camp, and I'll be damned if the Reverend Larry Arce didn't call the police on these people who were reclaiming their own property. He told the police that they stole this property from his facility. So they have to go through this whole story with the police department about how they were just getting their property back, that this guy had stolen it, and they were, in fact, had their property stolen, and they were just getting it back. I think it takes a lot of chutzpah for somebody like Arce to take people's property and then call the police on them when they reclaim it.
Unless, of course, he believes that the police will, as a matter of protocol, simply rubber stamp what he says.
Well, he says repeatedly that the police had given him authorization to clean up G Street. He had named himself the King of G Street, and he thought he had the right to go down and have his crews take homeless people's property and destroy it. And he did that. He even went, this was a year and a half ago, he sent his crews over to the encampment on the hill and took their Christmas ornaments off of the trees and the fence that borders the property. And he literally took every ornament and Christmas decoration that the homeless had put out and stole it.
He was only doing it for their own good, Mike.
I don't believe that for a minute. I just think the guy is pretty evil. And, well, so what happened was that they went to the Central California Legal Services. The homeless people got together and went down and said, you know, that they felt that their rights were being violated and they wanted to file a lawsuit against the Rescue Mission and Larry Arce. And the Central California Legal Services took the case and took them to court, and they just settled this week. And they, I guess what they got out of it was they got some kind of a monetary award, which I haven't quite ferreted out yet, just exactly how much it is. But I know they got some money, and they got changes in the policy for the Rescue Mission. And in all fairness, I haven't heard of the Rescue Mission stealing people's property for the last year or so. It's been some time since they've pulled those kinds of shenanigans against the homeless people.
But it's,
so,
it's interesting you have this Central California Legal Services. I mean, it sounds like Fresno, which is supposed to be this benighted area without medical marijuana dispensaries and, you know, lost in the boonies and in baking in the heat, has legal services. Of course, you're a much larger community than Santa Cruz. You have, what, 500,000 people there or something like that? Or?
Yeah, in the city itself, it's about 500,000.
So, I mean, it's obviously a much larger urban area. But you know, you have a group, and maybe that answers my response to my concern, that in liberal Santa Cruz, you have no legal agencies willing to take on the issue for homeless people who are being regularly having their property seized and destroyed and their tents shredded by Chief Ranger John Wallace and his labor-ready crews. So it's weird.
Well, somebody ought to take that case up, because in Fresno, the settlement was $2.3 million.
In the Kincaid case, the earlier case, right?
Yeah, that was.
What do you call this case, the one that's just come up? Has it got a title, a mission? I guess that we might call it the mission Rescue Mission case.
No, I don't have a title.
Well, the reason I originally called you again, and I kind of broadly got into it by suggesting what are the legal resources, and you've answered me somewhat by talking about this positive victory. It has to do with the case of a Glenn Beatty, who I'm looking at now. A fellow with a beard that is not quite as long as mine, but it's certainly whiter than mine, or maybe it's about the same color. According to this, what you write, I'm assuming you wrote this story, there's a February beating where the Fresno Department promised to investigate a beating by the police of this guy, Glenn Beatty, who, according to this, I'm reading your story, witnesses say he was sleeping under a tree, awakened by two Fresno cops. Video recording of the incident shows one officer holding him on the ground. You actually have the video actually on the website. People can go to it. Again, Central Valley Indie Media. And the other officer repeatedly punches him in the face while one holds him on the ground. And the officers were finally identified. I was looking for these names for a while. And you finally got him, which or somebody did. Jeff Gross, that sounds like an appropriate name. A 7-year vet. And Scott Payne, boy, another appropriate name. Who has been 10 years with the police department.
You couldn't make that stuff up.
It's amazing. Names were released in response to a lawsuit by the ACLU attorney. Now, and you actually have an ACLU that tries to do something for homeless people. Now, why, you know, have you considered dropping leaflets on our ACLU, possibly from a plane? Maybe send over a drone or something to wake them up? What do you think?
I don't know. Just they work. They're just on it here. It's not like, you know, we've held their feet to the fire or anything. They just, like, they did this on their own. They, you know, we pointed it out to them, what was going on, and they said, you know, we'll help you to get the names of the officers involved because, you know, by law, the city police have to provide that information. The police, of course, disputed that and said that they didn't have to provide that information and they wouldn't have provided it if the ACLU hadn't filed a lawsuit. And once they filed the lawsuit, as soon as the lawsuit was filed that day, they released the names. They said, oh, this isn't because of this ACLU lawsuit, but we, you know, we are legally within our rights not to release the names, but we've decided to release the names anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We have a similar problem with our Measure K committee, the group that's supposed to be monitoring the lowest, making sure the marijuana enforcement for all purposes, not just medical, is the lowest priority. And the police have successfully gutted this by removing from the legislation through consent decree between the city attorney and the people who passed the initiative the requirement that there be a police liaison, that their police provide records. And they're claiming that they don't have to do it because it's all discretionary. And the way they put it often is that they are prohibited from doing it, when in fact, of course, they're not in any way prohibited from doing it. They're all they engage in an expensive redaction process. If you want to get police records, you suddenly find that you don't get an opportunity to look at them, that they will instead redact them and then charge you to look at them because they say it requires them to print out the redacted copy, and therefore they will charge you 50 cents a page. This is what I find. In fact, you are under public records, you're allowed to look at public records, and then you can decide if you want to, you know, copy what you want to copy and so forth. But the police discourage this kind of citizen awareness of what the police department is doing in Santa Cruz by charging exorbitant prices. And I guess there's a similar, an even worse situation in Fresno, except that you have these legal advocates. I guess in larger cities, you know, that's the case. You know, maybe we can get San Jose to send somebody over, although that hasn't happened. It says it took 3 months of illegal delay in the case of Glenn Beatty, the guy who got beaten by officers Payne and Gross. what happened to those cops? I assume, of course, that they have immediately they're serving terms in jail for assault.
Well, here's the really interesting thing about this case, Robert, is that the person who was the victim of the crime, and this person, I just have no other way of looking at it, that poor Glenn Beatty, who was sitting there under a tree, he was asleep, just minding his own business. Two police officers come over. They beat the shit out of him. They take him to jail. The guy has been sitting in jail ever since. That was February 9th. They charged him with assaulting an officer. They have him in jail on a no bail felony.
Yeah, but he has a right to 30 days, to trial within 30 days. Why isn't he taking that option?
That I can't answer.
Because, I mean, normally, you know, his public defender may be fucking around with him. He has a public defender, I take it?
No, actually, he has an attorney. Not a particularly ineffective one. I mean, this guy's got a pretty good reputation.
Well, maybe the reason that he may be waiving time again and again in jail, but, I mean, it's not clear if he has a good attorney why he isn't being released OR pending the...
let me tell you a little more about the case.
Go ahead.
I mean, there's all kinds of things that are going on there. It has to do with they have declared Glenn mentally incompetent to assist in his own defense. And most recently, in the hearing that I attended a couple of weeks ago, they were trying to force him to take some medication against his will. And so his position was, no, I won't take the medication that you're trying to force on me unless I know what it is. They refused to tell him what the medication was.
Have you talked to this guy, by the way?
Glenn?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on his visitor's list.
Is he incompetent? I mean, does he seem unable to think clearly or to represent his own interests or...
Robert, he's as sane as you are.
Well, that's not saying much. I mean,
I didn't want to say that, but no, he seems reasonably competent to me. I talked to.
So you're saying the judges are colluding with the police and finding him incompetent? You're not suggesting your judicial system is corrupt in some way?
I'm suggesting that what's happened to this guy is grossly unfair. And that the city of Fresno has figured out a way to sequester him away for however many months this is, like 4 or 5 months now.
Right.
And so he's sitting in jail, and mind you, this is a jail where he is sitting in this cell with like 10 other people, 24 hours a day. He gets 1 hour a week to get out and exercise. And, you know, they're saying he's insane and he can't assist in his own defense. And they're trying, and the next thing they're going to do, and they've already said this, is that they're going to try to send him to a state mental facility like Atascadero.
Well, you've got to be crazy to challenge the police in Fresno.
Yeah. So
what's the bail on him right now?
There is no. It's a no-bail felony for assaulting a police officer.
That is there. What? No-bail felony?
Yeah. He is in.
Who's the judge who ruled that this was a no-bail felony?
You know, I don't have my notes in front of me.
Right,
I'd have to go back and find
this. This sounds like something from, you know, pre-French revolutionary France with, you know, they throw you in a hole with a letter de cachet or something, you know, or a oubliette or something like that.
It's kind of hard to believe that this is what's happened. So this is a guy that got victimized by the Fresno Police Department, and now they're covering it up by shipping him off to a state mental facility where they're going to drug him, you know, maybe with one of these psychotropic drugs that turn you into a zombie. And we may never hear from Glenn again. I mean, he may just be gone from whatever point they send him there forward. And
you
nothing
also,
will ever come.
You also mentioned that the internal affairs investigation inside the police department has not been completed, nor an independent investigation by the DA's office. Even though Police Chief Jerry Dyer promised the investigation would be reviewed by the California Attorney General, he's now saying he wants an FBI investigation. Have you contacted Obama, perhaps? I'm sure he'll come running in to help out.
He hasn't been returning my calls lately.
He's too busy with droning it up in Pakistan, I suspect.
I talked to the attorney, the lead attorney for the police department today. Because I did get a copy of the police report from her, and, you know, what this says is the police department's version of what happened. And on it, she had stamped that this is for my use only, and, you know, I was calling her saying, well, you know, this is a public record, you know, what do you mean this is for my use only? And she muttered some mumbo-jumbo about how they want to keep track of who gets copies, where are these copies, where copies...
Posted on IndieBay along with his picture, please. I mean, we need to see the police report. And it's a public document if you want to reveal it. It's up to you, I think.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. And she said, oh, yeah, no, you could do whatever you want with it. It's a public document. But she also said that the internal affairs investigation has now been completed, too. So while that's been completed, they're not going to release the results to the public.
Well, of course not. We would want the public to be unduly alarmed. Now, before we go any further in this, let me just ask you. You know that I've been. You know, we've talked a little bit about your search for the meaningless and ineffectual police auditor as some kind of control on the police department in Fresno, which I've expressed as, you know, useless, a form of reiterating a process that didn't work in San Jose and so forth. But you pointed out, well, you know, it's better than nothing, and people are mobilizing around the issue to get some kind of police, you know, accountability. And, you start with A and go to B, and then eventually you reach C and that sort of thing. You didn't say that, but I think that was the gist of it. Where is that at? Do you have any groups that are actually, sounds like, you know, that you as a journalist are the group. And the ACLU as a group of attorneys are the main deterrent, if you are a deterrent, to this kind of harassment. Although apparently it's not enough to get Glenn Beatty released, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we have had an effect. But, no, there are groups. There's a group called the Central California Legal Services, Central California Criminal Justice Committee that has been working on the issue of an independent police auditor in Fresno for years, and there's people that I respect on there, people that have worked hard in the community for years on numerous issues, you know, both police accountability issues, and other people who are on that committee have worked on peace issues or immigration issues, unions. So, you know, people who have a long history of work in social justice, and they bought in to the mayor's plan to support, to hire a independent police auditor, and that person in this model will have no investigative authority. They cannot investigate anything. They'll be allowed to read the reports from the IA's office, the Internal Affairs Office, but they won't be able to be in interviews and ask questions.
Yeah. I mean, this is all too familiar. We have a police auditor in Santa Cruz who's meaningless. He reports verbally once a year. When I asked him for his written reports, he refused to provide anything, although he's a nice enough guy. You know, he likes his $40,000 a year from the city council, and that's what he does. His name is Bob Aronson. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Mike Rhodes, a Fresno writer, activist, journalist, video journalist, who knows what, porta potty provider? Probably not. But anyway, you've been working on homeless civil rights issues in Fresno for about a decade now, or?
Yeah, it's getting to be about that. Yeah, quite a while.
The second issue that came up that you were going to talk about was Cynthia. Is it Williams? Is it Green?
Green.
Cynthia Green. Yeah, that's it. She apparently she got money for housing under the Kincaid settlement, but chose to live in a tent. Now, what's going on here? And their tent was burned up. Now, you better justify this for us all here. We're wondering, what are these crazy homeless people doing?
You know, Cynthia. So Cynthia lives at an encampment called The Hill. And a couple of nights ago, she was sleeping, and her neighbor had been burning a candle, fell asleep. The candle must have tipped over or caught something on fire. His place caught on fire first, fully engaged. I saw him. His name's Joe. Saw him the next day, and he just was, like, badly burned and just got out of the hospital with sort of, you know, welts and skin peeling off of his face. Pretty awful stuff. And so Cynthia, some of the people that were working on the street at 3 in the morning there came by and woke them up, and if it wasn't for that, they very well could have died. Now, here's the interesting thing, I think, about Cynthia is, you're right, she was one of the named plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the city of Fresno. She got a bunch of money. I mean, enough money to put a down payment on a house, which she did, and the house is in that same neighborhood. We bought a house, 3-bedroom, 1-bath house, 1/3 of an acre, for $28,500. So we're in the process now of fixing it up, kind of, you know, it's not in the best of shape, but it is a house, and it does have part of the land, and it's right in downtown, so it's pretty cool. So she wants to live there, but the city has, like, posted it that, you know, you can't live there, and that we have so many days to clean it up, to make a plan for how it's going to be habitable, et cetera, et cetera. And I just find it really ironic that here's somebody who's living on the street, almost died in a fire because of the condition she's living in. She owns a house, but she can't stay there while she's fixing it because the city code enforcement is so honest that, you know, people are afraid that she's there, they'll, I don't know what, arrest her or chase her off. I say she should live there and let them make the next move. And if they force her off, then they force her off. But I think she, you know, it's her house. She's one of the owners. She should be allowed to live there. It's certainly, I mean, it's just, you live in one place or another that, you know, you're camping at. So why not live at the place you own?
Yeah, I mean, that seems pretty clear. We're talking with Mike Rhodes. And, Mike, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to sum up anything else we may have missed, whether it's Cop Watch, Food Not Bombs, anti-war protests, SEIU shenanigans, whatever is going on in the city that, you know, that you may not have been able to get to. But give it about 2 minutes, and I want to roll because We've only got 15 minutes left in the show, but Jeremy Alderson, who's involved, of course, in the Homelessness Marathon, is we're going to be playing his torture song on Monday,
or actually on
Sunday. So you might want to tune in, or maybe you've already heard it, I'm sure.
I just heard it today.
He's got a song on torture, which is kind of fun. I'd play it today, but he wants me to wait until at least tomorrow, and so that means Sunday for me because we'll be back at 9:30 on Sunday morning. Any updates on any of these other subjects? Maybe you got a free radio station in the area that's just begun that we should know about? Or
now, I've heard a rumor. It's just a rumor. But I heard a rumor that somebody is going to start a pirate radio station in Fresno this summer. I think I know who the usual suspects are in that regard, but that would be kind of exciting to have a radio station in Fresno.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to call me all the time. I wouldn't have to call you. Actually, you call me, and I call you, and then you call me. But
something like that.
Yeah.
Let's see. One thing that was sort of left open that I wanted to say was that even though they have said they're going to hire an independent police auditor, they haven't done it yet. It's just sort of one of these positions that's pending, and so there's been absolutely nothing that's happened with it other than, you know, the new mayor, Ashley Swearingen, who's a Republican, and because of her position on the independent police auditor, got some support in the progressive community. And she, she has pushed through the IPA. That, you know, she's made that happen.
Independent police auditor.
Yeah, but you know, nothing's come of it yet.
Right. Well, nothing will come of it, even when it comes into force, I'm afraid.
I thought that, was understood. And she also, just last week, had a press conference out at the Rescue Mission where she gave them $20,000 or so as a donation from some fundraising event that she'd held. So that gives you an indication of where her politics are at.
She didn't donate to the actual... Oh, I don't know, the bail fund or the impeach the judge fund for Glenn Beatty.
No, she didn't. Also, let me mention this, too, that this house that we're building, we're kind of reconstructing over on Mariposa and B Street that Cynthia is going to be living at.
Right.
We have named that the Pamela Kincaid Neighborhood Center.
Okay.
And Pamela Kincaid, of course, was the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit against the city of Fresno. She was killed under very unusual, suspicious circumstances while the case was in court.
Has there been much retaliation against other plaintiffs in that case?
There was the case of Randy Johnson just about a week and a half or so ago where he had his wrists broken by the Fresno Police Department. As near as I can tell, he was just trying to get his wife's attention. Somebody called, said he was disturbing the peace, and the police came out and put his hands behind his back in such a way that broke them. So
mistake by the police. These things happen.
Well, I guess that's what they said.
Yeah,
he was one of the named plaintiffs too, and he thinks that it's related to the case. I don't think that there's any way of knowing with any certainty that it was or not, but he certainly thinks it was.
I hear you. Here in Santa Cruz on July 1st, we have a new organization taking over what's called the Hosts Program. It's called the Ambassadors or the Guides in other cities. These are sort of para-police eyes and ears who wander around town. Do you have a similar thing in Fresno?
They had tried to implement something like that, but it never really got any traction.
Here, of course, the hosts are notoriously, as are the police, either uneducated or unaware. It's kind of hard for people to really be aware in any really accurate way of the whole matrix, the spider's web of downtown ordinances that make it illegal to sit here, sit there, and so forth, which, you know, were set up by the city's by the downtown merchants in order to give the police selective enforcement powers to remove people they want. And this new hosts group, I think it's called the Strategic, I got to get the actual name of it, it's SGI, I believe, are the initials. And they're coming in on July 1st, and I guess you don't have a host anymore in Fresno. You just got the old FPD there?
Yeah, you know, they did that. They were hiring some homeless people to the ambassadors in downtown give people directions and stuff. But, you know, I never saw them anywhere. And I did talk to one of them one time who said that he was one of the people who the city had taken his property, and he was kind of upset about that. He was working for the city. He was still homeless, and the city came by and took all his tent and his sleeping bag and everything. He's complaining to me about that. So, but that's been some time ago. I just don't think that they're doing that anymore.
Well, maybe we should refer our downtown association, or actually our downtown management corporation, which is the group that's running them here, to the Fresno Experience. Mike, thank you for giving me the update. I encourage you to call back on Sunday if you have some more stuff that comes to mind or any more breaking news.
Okay.
You can hear another, you can actually sing along with the torture song when we play it.
It's on YouTube, too. They have a video of it as well.
Yeah, you can go there, I believe, and it's, I guess, what, Torture Jeremy will find, I'm not sure what you would Google to find, but.
Torture Jeremy?
Torture Jeremy. Actually, Jeremy is a guy who, didn't he write the song, or?
He's listed as the caterer.
Okay. Well, we'll be playing that on Sunday, and thank you very much. If people want to get more information, they can go to what? Is there a better website than the Central Valley Indie Media? Or?
Indie Media is good. You know, you go to indiebay.org and then click on the Central Valley. You'll get a lot of my stuff there. You can also go to our website in Fresno, which is FresnoAlliance.com, and you could read articles from the Community Alliance, which I'm the editor of. And there's also a link there where you can find all of the past stories I've written on homeless issues.
That's www.FresnoAlliance.com?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you, Mike Rhodes, and carry on.
Thanks, Robert. Talk to you later. Bye.
Right. Bye-bye. A busy man who's taken time out to talk with us. Check it out, www.FresnoAlliance.com, if you want more information. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. This is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. Coming up soon is Uncle Dennis' show, From the Cream to the Dregs. And Uncle Dennis is a harsh taskmaster. He will be arriving shortly, and his music will be arriving with him, whether we like it or not. So this is the last 8 minutes of the show is your opportunity to call in if you want to talk about any of these issues that have been raised, violence against the homeless, either here in Santa Cruz or elsewhere, the medical marijuana moratorium, essentially the drug war under a different name. It's the drug war masquerading as some kind of protective device, some kind of protective measure. I'm going to be talking more about it, playing more about this on Sunday. And you can read more about it by Googling for Medical Marijuana Moratorium Santa Cruz. I also noticed that the kind of free-form, what's it called, junk, secondhand junk you like. I'm not sure what the name of it is. It's the old Wired Wash Cafe in the back of the Saturn, right down from the FedEx Kinko's. It's been closed and locked since June 16th. It's got some notice on the door that says, I don't know, closed by the city because not habitable. I'm not sure. You're not supposed to habitate any of these places anyway. It's actually illegal under the city's infamous sleeping ban to fall asleep after 11 o'clock at night in any office building or movie theater or garage or, church, for that matter, downtown, in Santa, anywhere in the city, actually. And that's still the case. We are still going to be doing our protesting, our attempt to communicate to the community and get those stores who are willing to post pledges in their windows that, in essence, talk about the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, and that they don't discriminate. We already have about 10 of those stores which are agreeing to do that. We'll be signing up more. We'll be encouraging you to come on down and support this effort. For those of you who are listening and those of you who are concerned about these criminalization laws that criminalize essentially homeless survival, that'll be happening at 1350 Pacific Avenue in front of Bunny's Shoes, 1 o'clock on Saturday. And you're invited to come on down. If you want more information, you can call 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And you can also go to Santa Cruz Indie Media or indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. A couple of other things I've got here in the few minutes remaining here. What have we got here? I'll be talking more, as I said, about the medical marijuana moratorium. There's an interesting discussion on the Sentinel website. Usually it's all just a whole torrent of personal abuse. It's like slogging through shit. It's really depressing. But in this, on this particular occasion, there's actually some real stuff. So check it out. I hear someone pounding at the door, so I'm going to put on a little music while I investigate this questionable noise. Let's hear a little... what are we going to hear? We'll hear a little... an ancient folk song, perhaps. This may stir some memories.
John Brown went off to war to fight on a foreign shore. His mother sure is proud of him. He stood so straight and tall in his uniform and all. His mother's face broke out all in a grin. Oh, son, you look so fine. I'm glad you're a son of mine. You make me proud to know you hold a gun. Do what the captain says. Lots of medals you will get. And we'll put them on the wall when you come home. When that old train pulled out, John's ma begun to shout, telling everyone in the neighborhood, that's my son that's about to go. He's a soldier now, you know. She made well sure her neighbors understood. She got a letter once in a while, and her face broke into a smile as she showed them from to the people from next door. And she bragged about her son with his uniform and gun in this thing she called a good old-fashioned war. Lord, Lord, good old-fashioned war. And the letters ceased to come for a long time. They did not come. They ceased to come for about 9 months or more. Then a letter finally came, saying, go down and meet the train. Your son's coming home from the war. She smiled and went right down. She looked up and all around, but she did not see her soldier son in sight. But as all the people passed, she saw her son at last. When she did, she could hardly believe her eyes. His face was all shot up, and his hands were both blown off, and he wore a metal brace around his waist. He whispered kind of slow in a voice she did not know, while she could not even recognize his face. Oh, tell me, my darling son, pray tell me what they've done. How is it that you've come to be this way? He tried his best to talk as his mouth could hardly move, and his mother had to turn her head away. Don't you remember, Ma, when I went off to war? You thought it was the best thing I could do. I was on the battleground, you were home acting proud. Thank God you wasn't standing in my shoes. Lord, I thought when I was there, God, what am I doing here? I'm trying to kill somebody or die trying. But the thing that scared me most is when my enemy came close and I saw that his face looked just like mine. Lord, Lord, just like mine. And I could not help but think through the thunder rolling stink that I was just a puppet in a play. And through the roaring smoke, the string had finally broke, and a cannonball, it blew my eyes away. As he turned away to walk, his ma was still in shock, seeing the metal brace that helped him stand. But as he turned to go, he called his mother close, and he dropped his medals down into her hand. Lord, Lord, down to her hand.
And that was John Brown. That was Bob Dylan from an early Broadside recording. Or was it Bob Dylan? Yeah, it was written by Bob Dylan. I think it was sung. Okay. Still trying to find it out. Let's see. It's number 19. Don't know. But he either wrote it and it sounds like Bob Dylan. I think that's Bob singing. But that's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'll be back on Sunday, probably with a flashback during Thomas Levitt's show. We'll be probably picking up on the 1985 Board of Supervisors camping ordinance debate. Get to hear, well, if you know Officer Forbes, his grandfather was supervisor back then, so you can really get into the old times with us old timers. And you can hear how the same issues were being ignored in the same way back then, and the same outrages were being perpetrated. And so tune in if you're interested. That's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. 423-4833 is the number to call off air. If you want to talk to Uncle Dennis, call him on air at 427-3772. See you on Sunday, or perhaps, actually, maybe I'll hear you on Sunday. Ibbity, ibbity, ibbity. That's all, folks.
Won't you take me for a walk in the morning, do my honey? Won't you take me for a walk in the morning, sun, my love? You can't go walking in the morning, do today. You can't go walking in the morning. Listen, I hear a man moaning, Lord. Oh, yes, I hear a man moaning, Lord. You didn't hear a man moan at all. You didn't hear a man.
And Robert will be back on Sunday morning, 7:30, 8:30, 9 o'clock, something like that. I'm Uncle Dennis, and tonight we're going to do a special thing. I'm going to start my show by broadcasting dead air. The reason for that is that some of you may have heard that about a month ago, our mixing board died. Well, our mixing board is back. And so I'm going to take the first few minutes of my show to reinstall our repaired mixing board. That's the good news. The bad news is it cost us almost $500 to get it fixed. Now, we've gotten a $200 check as a donation towards that repair, so we need another $300. You know, the note from the technician was numerous ICs burned. Ah, well, it also took a power supply, shipping, and a bunch of time to get it repaired. But anyway, our mixing board is sitting here in a box. I'm going to open the box and we're going to install it. But while I do, there's going to be dead air because I can't turn Studio B on and put it on the air because the Studio B mixer is the one we've been using for the last month and a half. So bear with us, folks. A little technical advance here as we reinstall our main mixing board. Good news for programmers and for listeners. Both of our phone lines will be active again once the board's installed, as well as our full complement of stereo sources. So in addition to CD 1 and 2 in the phonographs, we will have CD 3, our VHF tape player. Robert's favorite cassette player will be back online. So stay tuned for all of that. But in the meantime, unfortunately, there is going to be some dead air. So bear with us, folks, while we do a little technical work in the studio.